Good morning. Some announcements. I won't be here, so I intend to lecture today and next week, and then we'll see what the interest in the audience will be, but I won't be here 2 weeks from today, so no class April 25th. And what I wanted to do is when I come back the week after, maybe we can have some class presentations of those of you who are so inclined and want credit for the class. If you want to do that, or if you don't, just write me an email and we'll make other arrangements. Also, Adam Gregson, whom I don't... Yeah, there he is. He sent me a link, but I didn't write it down. Do you know it? There is a conference in Snowbird in Utah in July on local cohomology, and as preparatory material for it, there are some notes on injectives in commutative algebra, so the role of injective modules in commutative algebra. And I'll try to think of bringing it next time, but if you can't wait till then, just send me an email. I'll send you the link, or send it to Adam Gregson. Huh? Okay, yeah. Okay, so last time talked about projectives and injectives and their role in calculating X. And so let me just remind you sort of the basic thing. So if, let's say, A is an abelian category with enough projectives, then x I a x y can be calculated as, and I'll give you a formal definition in a second, it's just restating really what we did last time, can be calculated as what's called the I-th cohomology of from a projective resolution of X into Y. So where P dot is a projective resolution, and the P really contains only the P's, not the end of it. That's just added here to remind you where it comes from. So this is a projective resolution. And I'll explain this notion for cohomology. This is just this kernel divided by the image that we encountered last time. But let me first finish the thought here. So then this can be calculated in this way. If the abelian category has enough injectives, then the same X can be calculated as by using an injective resolution for the other argument as HI HOM AX I, where again the Y is not part of I, why did I put primes? No idea. I1 is an injective resolution of Y. This is good news and bad news. It's good news because it says if you are lucky and you can find a projective resolution or an injective resolution, and we talked about how to do that, say, for modules over a principal ideal domain, then you actually can calculate the X groups. The bad news is that there are too many choices. For example, if A is an abelian category which has both enough projectives and enough injectives, should you prefer one over the other, or what is the relationship? Or maybe I can find something which is neither projective nor injective and will do the job and is easier accessible. So this whole business, really just this fluidity or ambiguity here in calculating these X groups, that is what is at the basis of the notion of a derived category. Because the basic aim in introducing derived categories is to make rigorous the dependence or independence on this kind of resolutions. So to get there, I'll need some preliminary work. Namely, we'll start by looking at complexes. And so a complex is a pretty simple notion. So it works in any category where you have a zero object, as you will see in a second. Most commonly, complexes are only considered over abelian categories for the reason which will become clear in a second. But let me formulate it first more generally. If C star is a category with zero object star, then a sequence of morphisms F, let's start, say, X naught, F naught, one is a complex if the composition of two consecutive morphisms, so Fi plus one, is a zero morphism for each I. And the dots mean that things can go on forever on both sides, both to the left or to the right. Now, often one doesn't want or doesn't need this kind of generality, so one says the complex is bounded below if XI is a zero object for all uh, I sufficiently large? In other words, you really start your complex somewhere on the left side. It is bounded above if Xi is a zero object for all I sufficiently less than zero. So in other words, the thing stops to the right. And of course, it is bounded if it is bounded below and above. So in other words, you have only finitely many interesting terms. You certainly heard me hesitate about the below and above business, because it is, it varies greatly in the literature. And it the reason is, it depends on whether you think of the maps lowering the indices or increasing the indices. So this is sort of, it's just a note. This is what's called homological notation. Whereas in the cohomological notation, you would put the indices up and the maps would increase the indices, and so the negative ones would appear at the left, the positive ones at the right. And the cohomological notation is sometimes also called the French notation, because that's what Grothendieck and his school used throughout, regardless of whether we're looking at homology or cohomology. And then you see below and above become sort of ambiguous qualities. So it is better, really, to make the distinction. So the better distinction, which is not very common, would be bounded in the direction of the difference. Yeah, okay. So one more piece here, sorry. So the Fi, well, yeah, that's pretty, that's, I like that. So the Fi are called the differentials of the complex. And so, we should better make clear in which direction the complex is bounded. So bounded in the direction of the differential. So if you like, this is BID. And bounded against the direction of the differential, that would be BAD, and then bounded both on both sides. Usually then BDD. Bounded in the future or past, I like that too. But just make sure when you read anything that you understand what the convention used is.
So, are you sure about your convention, though, that below means that for this thing, you
know? No, below.
When you say, when you talk about function, you know, function is down below.
I I think you're actually right, yes, because projective resolutions are normally considered bounded below. Sorry, see, I managed to confuse myself. And injective resolutions are considered bounded above. So just make sure whatever book you look at or source, you understand the convention used. Now, complexes per se, well, you can, of course, immediately say what you mean by a morphism. Well, that should be more or less obvious. So if we call this, and usually one puts a dot where one wants the indices. So x lower dot would correspond to this complex, and y lower dot would correspond to a complex like this. And then a morphism between the two is a family. No. Okay, so let's say the differentials here were labeled G's, and then a morphism H is a morphism at each stage such that all the squares commute. So with such that all squares commute. So it's easy to see that with this convention, one can define the category of complexes C of any category with zero object. So this would be category of complexes. And this comes from the French notation when it writes C minus for those which are bounded in the direction of the differential, and C plus for those that are bounded against the differential, and CB for the bounded complex. Now, the key issue is that if the category is abelian, so if A is abelian, then to say that Fi plus 1 equals 0 is the same thing as to say that the image of Fi plus 1 is contained in the kernel of Fi, and thus one can form what's called, now I have to be careful here, so we form the quotient, the kernel of Fi modulo the image of Fi plus 1, and that would be called the I-th homology of the complex X. So this is the I-th homology of X. And it is by definition, because the objects, the terms in the complex, the XIs, are from the category, so are the morphisms, thus so are kernel and image, and thus so is the quotient. In other words, these things here are objects in your category A. Right, so I mean the zero object in an abelian category is just denoted zero, of course, not just star. One crucial observation is that in an abelian category, or in any category with zero for that matter, one only needs to define H0 by sort of shifting literally the burden to the complex instead to the homology. So, two remarks. The first remark is that H upper I of X, so the I's cohomology, is nothing but the homology with the opposite index. And again, you see this, if you put the indices upstairs, then the I conforms. So the I's cohomology would be at the I's place, and it would be the kernel of the map going out modulo the image of the map going in. Now, to back up what I just said about shifting the burden, so if, and usually one also denotes the differentials by D instead of F, D or delta or whatever. So if this is a complex over the abelian category A, then one defines the translate X dot of 1 as the following. So I'll draw a picture, and I'll do it the French way. So here you would have D up 0, D minus 1, etc. And so the idea is that you shift the complex one step against the differential. So here you think of this term as sitting in degree 0, this in degree 1, minus 1, etc. And so the translate, sometimes it depends on what's more convenient, one also write it simply as T of X. So here is X, and T of X, or X shifted by 1, is the one where you shift against one step against the differential. So you get X0 sitting in degree minus 1, X1 sitting in degree 0, and so forth. However, there is also one tiny thing which you probably would think of as weird, namely, but at the same time, you take the same differentials, but you change their signs. So the differential becomes minus D0, minus D1, etc. So more formally, you see, and that explains sort of the arithmetic, the term in the translated complex in degree n is by definition x, then I should put the dots upstairs. That's the same thing as what used to be in degree n plus 1. So you see, in degree I'm minus 1, we have what used to be 1 degree up. That's the x naught. And the differential on x dot of 1 is minus the differential on x. And so, then clearly, that's just rewriting everything, and also noting that the kernel and image of the map and its opposite are the same. They are naturally isomorphic. So you have that hi of x dot is the same thing as h naught of x shifted by I. So instead of running all the way out to the I's place and take cohomology, you could as well pull back the complex I steps and take cohomology. Now, I said, what is a homomorphism of complexes? A second important notion is So first of all, let me say that H0 is a functor from the category of complexes over A to A. Is a functor. In other words, if you have, and now I switch to the cohomological notation because I'm more used to that, otherwise I'll get myself into a mess with the indices. If you have a morphism of complexes, then it induces a morphism in cohomology. Well, did I say that? No. So you can make this any I here if you like. And of course one should observe that I should have done right away before that the functor T or blank 1 is assigns to a complex over A another complex over A, and this is an equivalence of categories. Well, obviously, because you can shift to the right and you can undo the thing by shifting to the left. And of course, the iterates, so T to the I, is just going to be T applied I times. And that's also written as translate by I. And so then, if we modulo this remark, it would have been enough to state it for H0, because then it's obviously clear for all the HI, because HI would simply be H0 composed with T to the I. Now, what does this mean? It just means that the simple diagram one has to look at, so let's say we have X0 and here we have D0, D minus 1. And here we have the corresponding complex with Y's. Well, let's say DX and DY. So how do we see that? Well, first of all, we are given a morphism of complexes. So for what we are looking at in the zeros cohomology, you just need to look at these two, the terms adjacent to the zeros one. And so to say it's a morphism of complexes means that these two squares commute. Now, if I now look at the kernel of DX0, and I look at the kernel of dy0, so the kernel of this map, then, well, clearly, you see, if I go from the kernel to y0 to f0 to x1, this will be 0. So if I go like this, this will be 0. Why? Because if I go to here, this is 0, and so if I go up here, it stays 0. And this square commutes. But what is this saying? This is saying that the composition here is 0, i.e., this whole composed map, this map here, factors uniquely through the kernel. So there's a unique map F prime induced on the kernels. And similarly for the images. So if you draw here, well, I run out of space, but maybe I'll put it here. So if you look at the image of dx minus 1, and we know this sits inside the kernel of dx, And here you look at the image of dy minus 1, and we know it sits inside the kernel here. It's the simple matter to see that, again, you get a unique induced map morphism here. And thus, because the cohomology is supposed to be the co-kernel, you get a unique morphism here, and that's by definition H naught of S. Now, often you wouldn't want to do it in terms of diagrams, so let's assume we are dealing with an abelian category which can talk about elements. So let's say category of modules or what, something like this. What does the whole thing then mean? So first of all, what is H naught of X? Well, H naught of X consists of what's called cycles, modulo boundaries, where the cycles, and I should really say cycles in X naught, modulo the boundaries in X naught. So what are the cycles in X naught? Well, these are all the elements in X naught such that D of X equals 0. And I dropped the indices from the D because it's clear which map it is. There's only one defined on X naught. And what are the boundaries of X naught? Well, this consists of all the elements Y in X naught such that there exists some Z in X minus 1 such that dz equals y. Yeah, because the first thing, that's just another way to describe the kernel of D, all elements that get mapped to 0, and the boundaries are just the image of the differential to the left. And from here, it is you can see clearly, so if F from y to x, the morphism of complexes, then, well, just look at the definition. You see that f of the cycles of y naught is contained in the cycles of x naught, and similarly, f of the boundaries of y naught are contained in the boundaries of y naught. And this is just the same statement as to say that there exists this unique map f prime for the cycles, respectively f double prime for the boundaries. And so these two things together imply that f induces a morphism on homology or cohomology. Now, crucial thing, and this whole business about, of course, homology and complexes and what I'm going to say next about homotopies, that all comes from algebraic topology. All these concepts were first developed in algebraic topology and mainly in the context of simplicial homology. And you look at the triangulation of your nice topological space, and then you cook up a complex, which you cook up from the pieces of the triangulation, the vertices, the edges, the faces, etc. And then you realize that these homology groups do not depend on the triangulation of your space. Thus, they are invariants of your topological spaces, and that's where the whole theory started. And that also explains the terminology. So, given complexes X and Y, a homotopy from y to x is a family of maps, and I'll draw a picture, family of maps H I. So you have x naught, x 1, x minus 1, etc. You have y naught, y minus 1, y 1, etc. And mind you, amorphism of complexes would go straight from degree 0 to degree 0, degree 1 to degree 1, degree minus 1 to degree minus 1, and the homotopies go back one step. However, we do not require that the squares commute. Well, actually, no squares, but that these parallelograms commute. So no commutativity required. And what's the key issue? Well, you see, if you look at the, if you have a map of complexes, let me draw it like this. If you modify this map by the homotopy, so first, so here's a little lemma. If F from y to x is a morphism of complexes, h a homotopy, then first of all, the family f I modified by the two morphisms using the homotopy. So Fi plus Hi plus 1 dy plus dx Hi. So you add this composition and this composition is again a morphism of complexes. That's the first fact. And the second fact is, so let's call this Fi tilde. Moreover, the map induced in cohomology by F and the map induced in cohomology by F tilde are the same. And the reason is basically that what you're really doing is on the level of cohomology that if you look at cycles, so what is a map on cycles, then you see that F and F tilde differ simply by a boundary. Namely, let me write this out. I'll do it over here. So assume y in y wherever, let's say y0, is a cycle, i.e. dy of y equals 0. And let's look how this cycle gets mapped by f and f tilde. Well, then you see that f tilde of y, using the definition here, you see that the middle term disappears because dy of y is 0. So it is simply f of y plus 0 plus dx hi of y. But hey, this is a boundary. So in other words, in the cohomology of X, F tilde of Y and F of Y define the same class. And so that's very welcome news, because it says that you can, whenever you feel like it, you can simplify your morphism of complexes by adding a suitable homotopy. And you still see, get the same effect on cohomology. Now again, one can formalize this. Oh, you mean why you have this? Because if you drop it, you F tilde will not be a morphism of complexes. The first part would be wrong. You are right. Yes, something which sort of looks strange at first, for the proof that on the homology it has the same effect, this term doesn't come into play. But if you write out what it means to be a morphism of complexes, then you need this. I'll come to this in a second. So, given two complexes, X and Y, over some abelian category A, one can form, which arguably is the most important construction here, so-called the Homme complex. But this will no longer be a complex of objects in the category A. It will be a complex of abelian groups or of K modules if A happened to have a K linear structure. And how do we do this? Well, so we define Homme, and really should have, so it's a Homme complex, so the Homme complex in degree I of the two complexes X and Y. Well, what's a term in degree I? Well, it's something rather complicated. It is a direct product over all J in Z of Homme A from X J to, I started out by calling morphisms from Y to X, so let me stick with this for today. So it is, what does this mean? So these are families. So these are families of morphisms. And you see, for morphisms of complexes, it went from the same degree, from a degree to the same degree. For homotopies, it lowered the degree by one. Here, we are looking at families of morphisms that increase the degree by I everywhere. But I can be any integer. So these are just families of morphisms. No commutativity required. Where does the commutativity come in? The commutativity comes in through the differential on this complex. Namely, we define the differential of, and now I have to tell you how I, if I take such a family of maps, so let me call them H indexed J, and I think of this as being so it's indexed by J and Z, and so I think of this as an element in Homme I XY. Now what I do is precisely the same I did here. So in other words, I'll just form the composition in the two possible ways with the given differentials. However, to do this in a clever way, one has to throw in a sign. And so let me see how you do it. So you take dx composed with h, so maybe a little diagram might help. So we have, let's say, hj goes from yj to xj plus I. Now I apply the differential on x, so that goes to xj plus I plus 1. And on the other hand, I have the differential on y going to yj plus 1, and I have hj plus 1 over here. So I'll take hj plus 1 dy, and my morphism h is of degree I, and that's why I throw in minus minus 1 to the I. And so this is again over all j, and this is an element of product A from yj to xj plus I plus 1 over j. So in other words, this family here lives in I plus 1 xy. Now, why all the work? Well, look what's the kernel of D0, so the map defined on HOM0. Well, first of all, this is the family of all morphisms, HJ, from YJ to XJ, such that, and now just look what this equation means. This equation simply says, because this is of degree 0, so this extra sign disappears, dxhj minus hj, oops, somehow must have made a, no, that's okay, minus hj plus 1 dy equals 0, or if you rewrite this, dxhj equals hj plus 1 dy, and that's just going to say that this diagram commutes. So in other words, these are the morphisms of complex. So the cycles in the HOM complex are nothing but the morphisms of complexes. And what are the boundaries? So I claim that HOM in degree minus 1 of x to y, these are the homotopies, because these are just morphisms that go one place over to the left. And what we said, so if we have h in here, and we had F in degree 0, then you see, what is F plus DH? Well, if you write it out, This is, so of course, I'll drop the indices to make life somewhat simpler because they fill in by themselves. This is just going to be f plus h dx plus dyh. Note the sign here, because h is considered an element of degree minus 1, so this whole sign thing here becomes plus 1. And so that is to say, thus, h naught of the Hom complex from y to x, oh, again, I wrote x to y here. The Hom complex, the zeros cohomology of the Hom complex is equal to the cycles modulo the boundaries, as always. And what does that mean? It's the morphisms of complexes modulo homotopies. And so these are then, so H naught is also called the homotopy classes of morphisms of complexes. Now you see that these expressions become rather cumbersome, and you have to keep track of a lot of combinatorics. So one writes this formula for the boundary for D, quite simple. So one writes D as simply the bracket, and if you like, some people, the bracket with a differential. Well, I shouldn't put partials, should put D here. So how do you write, think of this? You think of this as saying that if you have D and you have some element H in the Hom complex, then this here expands to D times H minus 1, the degree of H, times HD. Okay? So this is precisely this formula here. Of course, if the D is in front, it is a DX. If the free D is in the back, it's a DY. There is no other way. The indices are the ones they have to be, and you see that the sign comes out properly. If you start from a morphism of degree I, that here is the degree of H, and that's precisely the formula over there. So then we can formulate the statement we had somewhere. It's probably hidden right now. No. You see, then, for example, to see, let's prove that F tilde, which is just F plus DH. So if you think back at 10 minutes ago, when we introduced the notion of homotopic maps, what it was is simply we replaced F by F plus the boundary of the homotopy. So I'll show to you now that this is indeed a morphism of complexes. So what to say that F tilde is a morphism of complexes means we need to prove that the bracket with D is zero, because this is to say it's a cycle. By the way, some people don't like this because of the sign and think of this as the ordinary bracket. So sometimes, in some sources, this is written with curly brackets to remind you that we are really dealing with so-called supercommutators. Right? They throw in the sign, but that's really besides the point. So let's prove this. Well, will this space suffice? Well, first of all, it is clear by just looking at the definition that this bracket is linear in the second argument. So we, in other words, we get that this bracket is the same as the bracket of D and F plus the bracket of D with D with a bracket here. But F was a cycle to begin with, so this is zero. F was a morphism of complexes. So as F is a morphism of complexes, and now the next step, perhaps I'll just write it out for you to see what's happening. Let's expand this piece here. So what is dH? Well, it is dH minus 1, the degree of dH d. Now, what's the first thing? Well, we just expand this bracket. Then you see this is d times dH minus 1, the degree of hd. And here we get minus 1. Now, let's make short this here. You see, if h was a family of degree I, then dh is a family of degree I plus 1. In other words, this degree is 1 higher than the degree of h. So this is the degree of h plus 1. And if we expand this piece, then we get dh minus 1 to power the degree of h, hd times d. And now look. Now we'll just expand. D squared is 0. That's part of the definition of a complex. So, we see that this piece is 0. Similarly, the last piece is 0, because dy squared is 0. So what's left over? Well, you see, the terms that are left over are of the form dhd. So it is just dhd with some sign. And so let's collect the signs. So from here, we get minus 1 degree of h. And from here, well, we have minus 1 degree of h here we are. So here we get minus 1, the degree of h, plus 1. Well, clearly this is 0. Yeah, very nice. Yes, we didn't prove this, of course, right? So, corollary. So you can frame it whichever way you want. Corollary, d squared equals 0. Well, d squared is equal to d blank is 0. Yes. And we didn't, I said it, but I didn't prove, of course, that capital D was a differential. Huh? I didn't?
You didn't.
Yes, I do, because otherwise I can't make this term disappear. Ah, that's absolutely true, yes. So now we get into string theory. So what Kentaro is saying, you see, to cancel these two last terms, all that would be required is not that d squared is 0, but if d squared is, say, 2. If it's 2 on both sides, then it still cancels. Yes. So, this is sort of the intermediate step between abelian categories and their derived categories, and that's this, the homotopy category. K of A. And we have everything what we need, namely the objects are, and again, it can come with some adornments here. So that could be plus, minus, or B. then the objects are sort of star complexes, so either bounded above, bounded below, or bounded, and morphisms. Well, you say that HOM, in the homotopy category of from Y to X, is by definition H naught of the HOM complex. In other words, it is the homotopy classes of morphisms of complexes. Okay, so important note, K of A is additive, but not abelian. That would be a bit much to ask for. However, the translation functor descends to an auto equivalence again denoted T which on the object is just what it was before, and it doesn't do anything to the morphism. So to describe it on the morphisms, so as you can see from the definition, one has that HOM, the HOM complex from X to Y, is the same as the HOM complex from Y to X, Y shifted to X shifted, because it's the same families of morphisms. Only the relative position of the two complexes that counts, not the absolute one. So in other words, if I take both complexes and shift them by the same amount, that has no influence on the HOM complex, and thus in particular doesn't have any influence on the homology, which are the morphisms in this complex. All right. Now here's a crucial notion. A morphism F between two complexes of complexes is a quasi-isomorphism and the French would say it's a homologism if the map induced in cohomology is an isomorphism. Well, let me be more precise so that there's no misunderstanding. Is an isomorphism for each I. Let me give you a silly example. That's actually not so silly. Let's say we deal with a category of abelian groups. And let's look look at your favorite finite group. Let's say Z2. First of all, I can think of this as a complex by simply placing it in degree zero. So sometimes people do not distinguish between the objects and the object considered as a complex where this object sits in degree zero and everything else is zero. If you want to be very precise, and that's what I would do in my papers, I would write it like this. But just saying, place it in degree zero. And all the rest is zero. So that's a complex. Now what we were interested in were resolutions. So let's look at this complex. Multiplication by 2. Well, I claim that there is a morphism, which is simply the projection, the natural projection. So this here would be in degree 0, and in cohomological degree minus 1, or homological degree plus 1. So minus 1 if you write it upstairs. So maybe I'll do a proper diagram. Of course, where there are only zeros, there's nothing much to describe. So the only thing to check that this is a morphism of complexes, well, you see almost all squares take care of themselves, right? If you start from a zero or you end from a zero, nothing to be checked. So the only square we need to prove that it's commutative is this one. Well, what is this saying? This is just saying that the projection onto Z2 after you have multiplied by 2 is 0. Wow. Big deal. Now, if you look at the homology here, of course, is Z2 because multiplication with 2 is injective. There is no homology here. There are no cycles. In particular, there is no homology. Here, the cycles is everything because it's the kernel of the zero map, divided by the image, which are the even numbers, so the homology is that mod 2. And the induced, and of course here, this is its own homology because everything else is zero. And what's the map induced in homology? Well, clearly it's an isomorphism. So in other words, this morphism of complexes is a quasi-isomorphism. However, we could as well look at the injective resolution. Well, how would that look like? Well, an injective resolution. Well, we saw that we can embed Z mod 2 into Q mod Z, send the non-trivial element in Z mod 2 to 1/2, to the class of 1/2. Now, I claim, if you look at, again, you look at Q mod Z, but place now in degree 0 and in cohomological degree plus 1 or homological degree minus 1, and you multiply by 2, then first of all, you get a canonical morphism from this complex to that complex. Well, as we already said, there's a canonical way of embedding Z2 into Q mod Z. And if you multiply 1/2 by 2, you get 1, which modulo 1 is 0. So in other words, this diagram commutes as well. Now, what's the homology of the top complex? Remember, Q mod Z is divisible. So everything is divisible by 2. So there is no homology at this place. So the homology here is 0. And what's the homology here? Well, which numbers between 0 and 1, if multiplied by 2, result in an integer? Well, that's just 0 and 1/2. So it's just Z2. So the homology here is also Z2. And of course, this map, sorry, maybe I'll write it here. Of course, the induced map is again an isomorphism. So this is also a quasi-isomorphism. And in particular, you see that the composition, which is obvious from the definition, is a quasi-isomorphism. Well, why not use isomorphisms? Because, you see, trouble is, there is no way to map back. We can go from the projective resolution to the object to the injective resolution, same way as here. But generally, there are no morphisms from the injective resolution to the projective one. Because what would that mean? That would mean you had to have a map from Q mod Z to Z. Well, as Q mod Z is torsion and Z is torsion free, there are no such maps. On the other hand, who says we need to use a projective or injective resolution? How about this complex in degree 0 and homological degree minus 1, homological degree minus 1, homological degree plus 1. Again, we can easily show that this is quasi-isomorphic to Z2. Right? That's just saying that this morphism is injective and its co-kernel is Z mod 2. So this is another quasi-isomorphism. So there are plenty of those. So one could argue, well, look, what you're saying here is really just that all we care about is a homology. Well, true, as long as the homology is concentrated in one single degree, you could as well simply say quasi-isomorphic complexes are the ones which have the same homology. However, this is no longer true if you have more than one cohomology group. Give you an example. Look at this complex. This complex has two non-zero cohomology groups. Namely, you get the co-kernel here, which is, let's say, to be specific, we put this in degree 0 and this in degree minus 1 or plus 1, depending on whether you think of it homologically or cohomologically, then H0 is going to be Z2, and H minus 1 is going to be Z2 as well. Now, the question is, should this be considered the same complex as this one? Because you see, this complex here has also two non-zero cohomology groups, and there are Z mod 2 in the same degrees. The answer is no. These two complexes are not quasi-isomorphic. Not so easy to prove, but so in other words, you cannot think of these as being sort of representing the same object up to resolution. They are different. Well, okay. That there is no quasi-isomorphism, yeah, you're right. So that we can still do by hand. But what I had in mind was something sort of, remember, it should look very similar to what we said about N extensions in abelian categories. How did we compare to N extensions? Well, we said we allowed a zigzag of morphisms of such extensions, and the same is true here. So you say that X and Y are quasi-isomorphic, if there exists a zigzag of quasi-isomorphisms, right? Because you see, we have a quasi-isomorphism going from this complex to that one, but nothing coming back. So if you want an equivalence relation, like for isomorphy itself, then, again, we need to use this trick of generating the equivalence relation. So we'll say that that X and Y are quasi-isomorphic if there exists a sequence finite sequence of such a zigzag where all the morphisms that occur are quasi-isomorphisms, where this sign means quism, quasi-isomorphism. And so then, it is not so easy to see that these two are not, cannot be connected even by some sequence of quasi-isomorphisms. Needs a bit more work. Huh? Well, the easiest thing is to show that one of the two complexes has some cohomological property the other one doesn't have. And so exhibit a property which stays the same under quasi-isomorphism, but which one of the two has and the other one doesn't. Exercise. Now, what does this all have to do with what we did so far? And there is the crucial statement. And then have a 10-minute break. So, given a complex X, but we think of it as an object in the homotopy category, define the quism category over X to be, have as its objects all morphisms Y to X, where F is a quasi-isomorphism. But mind you, now we are morphisms in K of A. So these are really homotopy classes of morphisms. And morphisms, well, are what you think they are. Namely, if you have Y prime, you have F prime. And you can make this triangle commute. So morphisms, so this represents, so G represents a morphism from F prime to F. Proposition: if X admits a projective resolution, and so, because X is a complex and not just one object, I haven't even defined what it is, it means X is quasi-isomorphic to a complex P in K minus of A. So in other words, it looks like a projective resolution. It's bounded in the direction of the differentials to a complex P with all of whose terms are projective objects from A, then two things. One, all projective resolutions of X are isomorphic, no quasi, are isomorphic in K of A. And secondly, each of these is an initial object in all the quisms over X. In other words, what does this really mean? This means that So you have X. You have some quasi-isomorphism. You have a projective resolution. So quasi-isomorphism. Well, of course, so I see a look on Drawer's face. I know something isn't quite right here. So so what does it say that X is quasi-isomorphic to a complex of projectives? Well, it means, by definition, there is such a zigzag, everything is a quasi-isomorphism. Well, the point, there are really two statements here, and maybe I should have inserted it. So the first thing is, if you have such a thing, then there is indeed, there exists a unique quasi-isomorphism here, but unique in K of A. So in other words, there's a unique homotopy class of morphisms. So that's the first statement. And the second statement is, moreover, there exists a unique quasi-isomorphism here, lifting through S, because that's the statement that it is an initial object. In other words, you can think of this, you have X sitting up here, you have all these wonderful quasi-isomorphisms, and you can have all these zigzags, of course. And down here at the bottom, you have your projective resolution. It dominates everything. And there are actual morphisms to each of these that are quasi-isomorphism and make all everything commute. But the price you have to pay is it's in the homotopy category. That is, you cannot necessarily construct these maps to commute on the nose. The only thing you can get is that up to homotopy, everything is fine. And what does this say? So this says that sort of the projective resolution is the best resolution going to X. It covers everything else. And of course, you can dualize the picture. The injective resolutions are the final objects in the quasi-isomorphisms coming from X. And so they receive every resolution of X. So these are the two extreme aspects of projective and injective resolution. And so to answer Masur's question is, to decide this question up here, all you have to do is construct a projective resolution for both complexes and see whether they are homotopy equivalent. If they are, the two complexes are quasi-isomorphic. If they are not, they are not. Okay, let's have a 10-minute break. Yeah, so. Okay, let's continue.
Briefly mention about this talk today.
Yeah.
Today there's a talk by Yukon Panchas, by Ratnam of 20 years here at the Frontier.
No, I won't. Won't be able to be here. Tycho, yeah. Tycho's leaving tomorrow. Okay, as I said, I should have inserted here sort of as 1.5. So if P is a projective resolution in this broad sense of X, then there exists a morphism of complexes P to X, which is a quasi-isomorphism. In other words, it's not necessary to go through zigzag. You can always, that's what I indicated in the diagram that I drew. They always map. The importance of this result is, first of all, point one, that it says it doesn't matter which projective resolution you create, they all serve the same purposes in terms of homological algebra. And that's just that they're all isomorphic in the homotopy category. Moreover, that each of them is an initial object, just saying you can't do any better. Because whenever you have a projective resolution, let me start over here. If you have a projective resolution, and let's say you were to try to resolve further, well, P is an initial object, so in other words, there exists a map backwards, which is a quasi-isomorphism, and it is moreover unique, so that the composition is the identity on P, because P is the initial object. So in other words, you could then as well, again, put P on top of Y. So you can't beat the projective resolution. That's what it means. Now, all this really boils down to is the following let's assume, and mind you, that a projective resolution is bounded in the direction of the differential. So let me try to explain what is really at stake here. What is at stake is precisely what I said over here. Namely, if F from Y to P is a quasi-isomorphism, then there exists a G from P to Y such that the composition, so way I can think of it, as you take the identity here, there exists a morphism G such that FG is the identity on P in K of A. And this is important because it means that this is not necessarily the identity, but it's homotopic to the identity, because we are dealing now with homotopy classes of morphisms. And you see, this is very similar to the property of being a projective object. Remember, the definition of a projective object was if you had a surge action here, then it splits. Now here, what we are saying is, instead of a surge action, we assume we are given a quasi-isomorphism, and we then say that the identity lifts over S. Now, one could prove this right as it is, but it is better and sort of conceptually easier to postpone the proof for a while and maybe skip it altogether, and instead of proving something else, namely, I claim that this statement here follows from the following fact. If you have a morphism, let's say if H from P to C is a morphism of complexes, and C has no homology, and C is what's called acyclic, means by definition all the cohomology of C is zero, then H is homotopic to zero. So let me give you an indication of how you prove this fact, and that's really the key fact in everything about projectives, and so the proof is very typical. So let's see how it works. Well, remember that P was bounded in the direction of the differential, so it stopped somewhere. So without loss of generality, by just shifting things around, I can assume it stops in degree zero. Otherwise, just translate everything until it does, or renumber things. Over here, we have our complex, and I promised I would use French notation, so I'll put the indices up. No. The assumption, you see, in my definition of a projective resolution was that P is bounded in the direction of the differential. But C is arbitrary. So I'm given a morphism of complexes. So H is a morphism of complexes, and also I assume that the cohomology of C is zero. No, well, whatever you prefer. I wrote H here. If you want to rename it F, be my guest. And so each PI is projective. So these are really the hypotheses we are making. And then I claim that there exists morphisms like so, and maybe I call them capital H. So then there exist morphisms capital H I from PI to CI minus 1 such that small h equals D capital H. Right? This is the claim. Because this is saying that the map H is a boundary in the homomorphism complex. And you will see immediately what this, just unravel what it means. You see, of course, the map H1, so in other words, what happens way over on the right, there is no choice. Because you have zeros here on the bottom, well, what maps can you take? So in other words, you have to have that HI is 0 for I greater than 0. That just comes with the territory. No choice. Okay, so now, of course, then this triangle here doesn't amount to much. This composition is 0. So we haven't done anything. So the whole burden falls to this side. So what does it mean? So what do we need? We need, so the claim is there exists a morphism H0 from P0 to C minus 1 such that D on C times H0 equals little h0. Well, why is that so? Well, somewhere we need to use the hypothesis that C has no homology. So, but look, by assumption, so as H0 of C is 0, what does that mean? That means that the kernel of D0 is equal to the image of D1, D minus 1. On the other hand, so now we are just unraveling what this diagram says. Because we have commutativity of this square, so this commutes. Well, what does that mean? That means that this composition up here, that D times H0 is 0, because it is certainly 0 if you go this way. But this means that H0 factors uniquely through the kernel of D0. On the other hand, the kernel of D0 is the same . So here we had C0. Let me draw it like this. The kernel. Here we had P0. And so we already said there exists a unique factorization of H0 through the kernel. That's because this one commutes. On the other hand, if you go further back, well, what does it mean to say that the kernel equals the image of D minus 1? This is to say that this one here is surjective. D minus 1 factors through the kernel of D0, and to say the image is the same means this is surjective. So this is the same thing as to say that H0 is of C is 0. But hey, P0 is projective. This is an epimorphism, and P0 is projective. So that means there exists a lifting. It's no longer unique. Right? Just imagine, for example, that this is a direct sum of the thing with something else. Then we don't care what happens on the something else. All we care is that we get the right stuff on here. And so we call this map here, which exists, call it H0. So, in other words, choose H0 from P0 to C minus 1 such that, well, let's see what we need. Well, exactly. You see, if you unravel this, then we have that the composition of H0 with this projection onto the kernel is this map. So that means that if we take D minus 1 and compose with H0, so we take this one, well, it's the same as this composition is the same as this composition is the same as H0. In other words, we have done the first piece. Thus, we have that H naught equals 0 plus d minus 1 dH naught plus H minus 1 d. Because remember, H minus 1 was 0 to begin with. And now, replace the given map H by H prime, where H prime in degree 0 is 0, H prime in degree 1 is H1, in degree minus 1 is H minus 1 minus H naught d, whatever we need, probably minus 2. So in other words, you see, we have now, in this situation, no, d minus. So, what we do is we just modify the situation by subtracting this composition here from this map and putting 0 here. Then, and so the rest, so H prime I, H prime I is the same as HI for I less than minus 2. In other words, if we go further to the left, who cares? And now you see we have reduced it to the situation we had before. Well, we don't have the zero object here. We have P0 here, but we have the zero map. And if you look at the argument here, the only thing we used was that D0, H0 was zero, and which in the first step was automatic because we passed through zero. Here in the second step, we just force it. And now simply repeat. So we construct inductively these pieces, H upper I. But notice that it is important that you can start somewhere. And this is why it won't work if you have a complex of projectives which is not bounded against the differential. Because in that case, you have no place you can start. Won't work. So, now, this establishes this little fact here, that morphisms from projectives to acyclics are homotopic to zero. And I will spend the rest of the time today to explain what this fact has to do with this fact. And this leads to a concept which at first glance has very little to do with it, but is at the basis of sort of what's called the triangulated structure on the category Ka. Remember, what we said was if we start with an abelian category, then the basic concept there are short exact sequences. And if you look at the extension groups, then we get these mysterious connecting homomorphisms that string all the X for a short exact sequence together. And now we're trying to mimic this on the level of complexes. And I know if you see this for the first time, it is hard to swallow. So I think I'll give you as an interlude the so-called horseshoe construction. Because it allows first to see why this kind of construction comes up naturally, and also it will then make it a little bit more intuitive, this question, the construction of mapping cones and mapping cylinders. So what's a horseshoe construction? So assume that A is an abelian category with enough projectives. I leave it to you to do the same thing if you have enough injectives. In other words, to dualize everything. Assume, given a short exact sequence, zero goes to x, goes to y, goes to z, goes to zero in A. Together with, well, I should say, 2 out of 3 projective resolutions. So in other words, assume you are given already 2 projective resolutions for 2 out of the 3 terms. Then there is a canonical way to produce a projective resolution for the missing one. Then one can produce a projective resolution of the third one as follows. And the classical horseshoe construction is when you are given, and it's also the more complicated case, is a case where you have given projective resolutions on the two ends. So, and the name horseshoe comes, of course, from this picture. So you have a projective resolution for x, you have a projective resolution for z. So this is your horseshoe, and what you want is you want to fill in the middle. Yeah, otherwise, what I'm going to show you is not going to work. And you see, if you don't have enough projectives, that means, by definition, that there are objects in your category that do not have projective resolutions.
Right, but they don't necessarily fit into such short exact sequence.
Huh? No, I mean, these X, Y, and Z could be arbitrary objects in A.
No,
That's still true. That's still true, yes. So you could localize the statement by saying all you need is that two of the three objects have a projective resolution, then so does the third.
Even if there aren't enough projectives.
That's right, yes. It's only a local statement. It only refers to properties of these objects. Okay, so the idea how to work it out is relatively easy. But let me be more specific. So let's say this map is A, this map or morphism is B, and here we have our given differentials. So how do we construct a projective resolution for Y? Well, point is, you start by filling in the direct sum and completing this. So this would be the split exact sequence. Right. Remember, whenever we have two objects, we can form the direct sum, and this defines a byproduct. So in other words, we have, here's the first inclusion, this is the second projection, and we also have a splitting, which here's the second injection, and this first projection. Now these maps, let's call them P and Q, they are given to us and they are surjective because P and Q are projective resolutions of X and Y. So what I want, I need to fill in this morphism here to make everything commute. That's what I want. So how do I do this? Well, because this is a direct sum, maybe I'll do it here on the side. And if I wanted to commute, then what happens on P0 is already given to me, right? Because P0 includes into here, and on the other hand, I can go like this, So in other words, on P naught, the morphism has to be A composed with P. So from here to here, it is AP. But at first, I'm at a loss to say how to define anything from Q naught to Y. But that's where it comes in that Q naught is projective, because B is by definition epimorphism. Thus, I can lift the morphism Q through Y, call it beta. So as Q naught is projective and B is epi, there exists a beta from Q naught to Y such that B times beta equals Q. And so I fill in this morphism in the middle simply as AP plus beta. Now let's see that this makes both diagrams commute. Well, commutativity of the left square is clear because this is just the inclusion. If I compose this with the first inclusion, then it doesn't see beta because beta sits only, well, maybe I should be more precise here. I should define this, of course, to be so on P naught. So this is the composition. This is AP, the projection, first projection, and this is beta, second projection. So I claim, so this, the commutativity of this diagram is okay. Why is the commutativity of this diagram okay? Well, because if you look at the composition of B with this sum, then B times A is zero, because this was an exact sequence. Thus, we simply get B beta, which is Q to begin with. So we have that B composed with AP plus beta is equal to B beta because BA is zero, and that's Q, and thus this diagram commutes as well. Okay, so that's the first step. Now how do we continue? Well, the continuation is simply, again, by induction. Look at what happens to the kernels. And this is another important fact. So let's look at the situation we have. No, sorry. And so here, and well, could just say it's the kernels, but because we are going to continue in this way, I'll give them another name. I'll just call them omega 1 of x. These are the first syzygies of x in this resolution. And here we have omega 1 of z. But the definition is just it's a kernel. This was P, this was Q. And I put the kernel here. And now there are various claims about it. So here's some properties of this diagram. So let's, which I will call this thing in the middle, PQ, let's call this R. So set R equal to AP plus beta. So here's some properties. First of all, R is an epimorphism. Now, why is that so? Well, this is sort of one of these, if you do it in terms of elements, it's sort of straightforward. Take an element from Y, and you want to show that it is R of something. Well, You don't know anything about it. What can you do with this element? The only thing is you can map it to the right. Okay, so take your map, take your element y, map it to the right. Q is surjective. So this element that you got here, so I'm sorry for this. I know it's messy to take notes here. So this goes to B of y. Let's call this z. Now this one, there exists a pre-image. Let's call it u. So that's such a z is q of u. On the other hand, this morphism here is surjective. Even it's even split. So I can go from here back here by just sending it to 0 comma u. Now, there is no reason that this should map onto y. However, if I take the difference here, if I take y minus r of 0 comma u, what happens? Well, as far as this corner is concerned, you can't tell the difference. In other words, this goes to 0 in z. But that means, because this sequence is exact, it comes from something in x. And this element in x has a pre-image in P0 because P is surjective. And so you just modify this one. So let me write it down. So first of all, there exists, and I'll do it in elements, and I'll leave it to you to do it just a diagram chase without ever mentioning elements, so that there exists a U in Q0 such that Q of U equals B of Y. And then it follows that Y minus R of 0 comma U equals P of A of some X. P of A, well, of some V. V is in here. And it then follows that Y is equal to R of V comma U. So in other words, this map here in the middle is surjective. Sorry. This one is surjective. Moreover, the next properties is to fill in the maps here. First of all, I claim that these morphisms induce morphisms on the kernels. Moreover, this is a short exact sequence. So the next statement is the kernels form an exact sequence. End of the story. Because, remember, P and Q were projective resolutions of X and Z. So in other words, I can replace my original diagram by this one. And because it was a resolution, the kernel of the first map is the same as the image of the second. So in other words, this is surjective. And this cut complex is a projective resolution and sort of P minus 1 omega 1 x is a projective resolution. Of omega 1 x. Similarly, q minus 2, q minus 1, omega 1 z to 0 is a projective resolution of omega 1 z, and so on. So, details left to the reader. More important is what we get in the end. What do we get in the end? And I'll just write down the first few steps. Here in P, Q, homomorphism R. Namely, what is the new morphism here? Well, if you think of it in terms of a matrix, so we have P minus 1, Q minus 1, P naught, Q naught. Now, on this side, so the left triangles, we'll just have the inclusion. So the map from P minus 1 is simply going to be dx. And no Q component. However, if you look at what happens here from Q minus 1, well, then remember the next step, what we would do is we would take dy and lift it. So we would get here dy, and here we would get this lift, which we earlier called beta. So we get some map beta minus 1. So I hope you forgive me if I just copy it like this. And the little computation we did to show that the sequence of the kernels is exact is saying, if you translate it into a diagram, that if we keep on doing this, so I'll just do one more step. So here we have dx, 0, dy, and here we get beta minus 2. It says that the sequence of maps we form in the middle will be a complex. So the claim is that the pi plus qi together with these morphisms, dx, dy, 0, beta I, to pi plus 1 plus qi plus 1, is a projective resolution of the middle term. Well, because I chose to call it that, right? I call these the X's that's definitely stupid. Yes, it was just meant to confuse you. Sorry. Should be the Z's, right? Yeah, sorry. Okay. Now, that the terms are projective modules, that's obvious, because the sum of two projectives is projective. The real statement here is two things. The first is that this is a complex. Now, what does it mean that this is a complex? Well, here's your basic matrix calculation. Let's just multiply these two matrices. Well, you get in the top corner, you get dx squared, which is clearly zero because dx is the differential on the projective resolution of x. In the lower left corner, you've got 0 for free. In the lower right corner, you get 0 because it is really dz squared, which is 0. So now, what happens in the upper right corner? Well, you see you get dx, beta I minus 1, plus beta I dz. So, what is this saying? Remember what these morphisms beta, where is my matrix here? Where are the betas? They are in this corner. So they are morphisms from Q to P with one tiny difference that they increase the degree by one. So this equation says that the family of the betas is a cycle in HOM Q to P shifted by one. So is in there, because that's just saying it increases degree by, increases degree by one and is a cycle. Moreover, not so surprisingly, if you now go back through the whole construction and say, well, there were some ambiguities here. Like, for example, the beta was just some lifting of Q through Y. So I can take a different one. Well, be my guest, right? So that means if you take two different liftings, they differ by a morphism factoring through X. If you do this, and for the whole resolution, what you will see is that this family of morphisms, beta, that we have constructed here, defines a unique cohomology class in the HOM complex of degree one. So the upshot of the whole construction claim is the class of this family beta I in H1 of the HOM complex from Q to P is independent of the choices. It only depends on the given exact sequence. Now, what this means, and that's where sort of the next what it is supposed to motivate, is we replace X by a projective resolution. We constructed a projective resolution of Y, and we had a projective resolution of Z given. So these are projective resolutions. But the interesting thing is that, so here we had A, here we had B, and let's call this alpha and beta, just the maps between the resolutions. The interesting piece is, oh no, I knew I should have called it gamma. Oh boy. Let's call it A tilde, B tilde. And then what are the betas? Well, the betas are morphism from Q to P of 1. That's just covered down there. This equation says it's a morphism of complexes from Q to P of 1. So out of nothing, really, out of thin air, we have extended our exact sequence by one further morphism. That's how you can read it as well. The morphisms A and B lift to the projective resolutions, and doing so produces in the process another morphism of complexes. So the morale is a short exact sequence of objects produces a a triangle of complexes. Why triangle? Because in the sort of to shorten what we have here, one writes it, although it's terribly stupid to typeset this, one writes it often like this. A tilde, B tilde, beta, and then you have to indicate that this is a morphism of degree 1. It goes from this complex, but not to P, to P shifted by 1. And so if you display it like this, then this is a triangle, and that's the one which is meant here. But it is really better to straighten, and by now, so this was in the, when Grothendieck and company came up with this whole theory, originally it was displayed as triangles like this. But then I think it has become clear over the years that it's better to stretch these triangles out like this because it much better matches where it comes from these exact sequences. Also, and this is sort of where things are really perhaps going a bit, become really strange. Now let's look at R. Let's go back and look at the horseshoe construction. What is it really that entered here? Well, it was the projective resolution of X, the projective resolution of Q, and we can turn around and say that the differential of R was really built up from the differential of P, the differential on Q, plus this extra map beta. So in other words, you can argue that all you need to know to reconstruct this diagram is this morphism, because it involves already the complex Q with its differential, it involves the complex P with its differential, and it involves a morphism beta. And that's all. So that's all we need to construct the resolution in the middle. So what's the general what's the general upshot of this? Well, you turn around and say, well, how can we make this kind of construction functorial and start with a morphism beta? And so this will be the last topic now. So, mind you, I did not say anything about exactness of this sequence here. I just said I have morphisms of complexes. I didn't say anything about exactness. Yes, of course. It happens that in this case, A tilde and B tilde on each layer give you an exact sequence. That's right. But that's not the key issue here. The key issue is what is the information that is contained in R. Because you see, these horizontal maps on the resolutions, they are just the inclusions and projections. There is nothing happening. So to say that this is an exact sequence of complexes is the same thing as to say that term by term, this complex is a direct sum of this and this. So, in other words, the role of the exactness has been completely downplayed by making these maps trivial, and all the information has been packed into this morphism. So now we go backwards. So we assume we have a morphism between two complexes, and what is it that creates this one in the middle? Well, and that's so-called mapping cone construction. And for good measure, there's not only a mapping cone, but also a mapping cylinder, and of course the terminology, once again, comes from algebraic topology, where these things occur in really concrete terms. Now, clearly, we are now going backwards, so there will be some differences, some difficulties in matching the two, because now we'll start with a morphism F from, well, maybe I'll just, for good measure, I'll just call it C to D of complexes, so that don't think it refers to that you, so C would be Q and D would be P of 1. So the question is, how do we construct R? Well, the mapping cone over F, also written as cone of F or C of F, depending on how patient you are and how much space you have, is given by the following. So, let me draw a picture again. And I'll draw the complexes vertically. So here I have, say, C0, C1, C-1, etc. And I don't assume any boundedness condition. D1, D0, D-1, and I have this morphism. And this is a morphism of complexes, so everything commutes. And I'm going to construct a new complex, namely this one, and so I have to say, well, what is CF in degree, say, 1? Well, the idea is you take the complex D, you take the complex C, but you shift C one step back. So in other words, you shift this object over here, sum them up, and think of this sum as a differential. Doesn't work quite like this, but if you take care of the signs, then it does work. So you take D1 plus C2, and here you take, in degree 0, you take D0 plus C1, etc. CF minus 1 will be D-1 plus C0. And so now we need to give... No, I'm just saying, I take this piece and move it next to this one. There are no arrows here. I'm just describing sort of physically what happens. You shear the picture, yes. And so what are the differentials now? Well, maybe pedagogically would have been better to write the complex upside down because the maps would look nicer. So let's see. From D0, C1 to D1, C2. So what do we have? Well, from D0 to D1, we have the original differential on D. From C1 to D0, we have, from C1 from D0 to C2, there's no obvious morphism in the picture, and there isn't anything we can do, so I'll put 0. From C1 to D1, we have the given map. However, and I'm going to comment on this, one puts instead of F, one puts minus F. And so what is left over? It's a differential from C1 to C2. But mind you, that we have sheared the picture, and we said earlier that translating a complex changes the sign of a differential. So one puts here minus DC. So this is going to be the differential on C of F. Now these two minus signs are really worth a story, and I'm really curious how historians of mathematics, say in 50 or 100 years from now, will untangle what had happened. Because this is Bourbaki convention, and there are some good reasons to do it, to make certain constructions of higher order cohomology operations come out without too many signs attached. Similarly, the construction here. But when the whole business started in the late 50s, 60s of the last century, well, people did not pay attention so much to these fine points. And so you find all sorts of variations as far as these signs are concerned. So the most typical one is that there would be no sign attached to this morphism here. So you would see the definition of the mapping cone as being the differential being here without the minus sign. And so, but it doesn't really matter because then one is a mapping cone of F, the other one is a mapping cone of minus F. And that's because it doesn't really matter except when you are really meticulous. That's where the whole confusion comes from. And quite frankly, I get myself all the time confused and I try to do it really right and get all the signs straightened out and so on. And I wonder myself what will be the final version we will settle on. And I think it will take probably another generation or two until we fully understand what is the right pattern of signs that should be here in the picture. Well, whatever it might be. So let's take this as a definition. Then again, it's the same calculation we did there. You see that DCF squared is zero. The same matrix calculation as before. All that it requires is that this morphism up here in the corner is a morphism of complexes. That's the only non-trivial entry in the product matrix. No, because you see, we're just going to shift this morphism, this complex down. So that means all the different, you change, translating by one changes the differential, the sign of the differential, independent of the position. No. Don't do this to me. maybe, yeah. Yeah, I don't. So, crucial thing is this matrix satisfies this matrix equation, and it makes this into a complex. And this is called the mapping cone of F. Now, I claim it plays exactly the role of the R over there. However, to increase your confusion, maybe enough. There is a canonical exact sequence of complexes. Namely, you take the complex D and embed it. So you get the complex D. You take the first inclusion into the mapping cone of F. And that's obviously a monomorphism at each stage. And you project on the second summand. However, if you do that, then of course it's not the complex C, but the complex C shifted by 1. And what does it mean it's a short exact sequence of complexes? This means two things. It means that in each degree, the resulting sequence is exact. Moreover, the two morphisms there are morphisms of complexes. Now let's look at this example. So we started with our morphism beta, which went from Q to P of 1. And now we want to take the mapping cone over this. So we get an exact sequence from P of 1 into the mapping cone of beta into Q of 1. Right? Because we started with a shifted version of P already. Now, where's the connection to the horseshoe construction? Well, here's a claim. If you look at the, what's the differential here look like? Well, it's a differential on P1, right? No, sorry, the differential on the, yes, on the image, on the target, which is this complex here. Here we have minus the differential on the source, which is Q. And here we put minus the morphism. Now write this out. This here will be minus dp because I have shifted the complex p by 1. Here we have minus dq. And here we have minus beta. However, if you compared, then I claim that c beta is nothing but r shifted by 1. Well, term-wise, this is certainly okay. And if I shift by 1, then this means that the differential differs by the sign. And you see, this is precisely what happens. The differential for R was dp dq beta and 0. And you see, this is why you plug in these two minus signs, in other words, so that if you compare it with a horseshoe construction, you get the right thing. So up to the shift by 1, so in other words, this mapping cone construction constructs the sequence of resolutions shifted by 1. Otherwise, it's the same thing as before. All right. So now, let's forget about resolutions and let's just look at complexes. So, we start with a morphism of complexes, F, and out of this, we construct a short exact sequence. Moreover, there is a second short exact sequence, which looks like this, which starts at C. Sorry. Here we have the cylinder of F. And we have natural morphisms such that the composition here will be F. Shifted by 1, yes. And the cylinder, you see, you want this to be an exact sequence. So remember, what was C of F? It's over there. So C of F, the terms in here are simply, it's D plus C shifted by 1. If you just think in terms of the terms. And the differential, of course, was this matrix. Now, again, we want this to be a split exact sequence on each level, so there's no choice what we should put here. So this will be C plus D plus C of 1. So that this becomes the first inclusion, and this here becomes a projection. This map here becomes the projection onto the second and third summit. Now, of course, this leaves the question of the differential. And I leave it to you, because just from the from what we require, it is automatic what we have to fill in. And the only thing is to check that it works. Namely, we want that this is a short exact sequence, which determines essentially the matrix for, it's like over here, right? The lower triangular part came just from the fact that we had this exact sequence, and it was only sort of the upper right corner where we had freedom to put something. Same thing here for the cylinder, and the freedom is curtailed by the requirement that this composition here, and where this here is, of course, what is this? So this here will be the map. Okay, so let's call this, I run out of letters. So this map here will be F on C and the identity on D. So with this requirement, there's only one way you can put a differential on here to make everything work. Now, I could write it down for you, but I'll ask you to check it yourself. The key issue here is the following. You see, normally we would like to say, well, let's say if F were a monomorphism, then we could easily make it into an exact sequence by adding the co-kernel of F on this side. If F were an epimorphism in each degree, we could simply add the kernel and make a short exact sequence on the other side. In general, F is neither surjective nor injective, or epi or mono, so we need to have a substitute. And the substitute are these two exact sequences. So, and I showed you essentially by the horseshoe construction that to give this short exact sequence is the same thing as to give this morphism F. This is this upper corner in the differential of the term in the middle. Similarly, you see, you want to be able to take these short exact sequences and shift them around. Because what this construction does is now you can repeat everything. So let's call this here F tilde. What we have done here is really we have replaced F by a monomorphism to make this into a short exact sequence with a co-kernel. And so this here is sort of the conversion of the morphism into a short exact sequence, and this exact short exact sequence corresponds to this third side of the triangle, because it shows how this short exact sequence continues on to the shifted copy of C. Now, how does one formalize this? Well, one formalizes it as follows. And you say that a category D is a triangulated category. And I'm going to give you the complete list of axioms next time, but I just want to give you the idea. What do we want? Well, first of all, we want its additive. Second, we want the existence of a translation functor. And it should be really a translation auto equivalent. So these are sort of the innocuous data. The crucial thing is we should want to remember the exact sequences. How do we do that? Well, by encoding this notion of triangles. So we have a family of so-called distinguished triangles. And what are such things? Such things are simply sequences x to y to z to x of 1, u, v, w. And some family, I should really make sure that you understand this is part of the data. It does not come out. It will come out if this triangulated category is constructed out of an abelian one. But in abstract terms, all you require is these, that you are given such a thing. And what are the necessary actions? Well, the necessary actions are, for example, that you can translate triangles. Again, there's a very fine point about signs, namely, so let's say if you shift it to the left, you want that y minus v, z minus w, x minus u, minus w goes to, yes, goes to x of 1, minus v of 1 goes to y of 1, is again a triangle, is again distinguished. Very minor point, if you drop the signs, normally it's not a distinguished triangle, only in characteristic 2. So that is sort of just part of the game. The second thing is that every morphism F from X to Y embeds into a distinguished triangle. And this is really the mapping cone construction, what it amounts to in the classical case. So in other words, what this axiom says is simply that if you have any morphism from X to Y, then you can complete it such that this is a distinguished triangle. It doesn't say it's unique. Usually it isn't. It just says there exists such a thing. It can be embedded into a triangle. Next axiom sort of restores some uniqueness. Namely, it says if you have two triangles, well, let me and you have a morphism F here and a morphism G here. Then obviously you also get F of 1 here, the translated morphism. And so the next axiom then says there exists a morphism here which makes it commutative. Again, it doesn't say it's unique. Usually it won't be. So, extending morphisms of triangles. And I think this is it. At least that's as far as the algebraic topologists got at around 1958-59. And they forgot one axiom. Well, forgot is perhaps not the right word. They simply didn't see it as being part of the structure, and that we will have some fun with. And so this is plus the so-called octahedral action. Now the octahedral action says that, assume you draw your favorite octahedron. Let's say I'll draw it from the top and the bottom. I'm not orienting my maps yet, because for this I will have to look it up. So the basic thing is that you have if you have well, I'm going to make it more precise next time. I'll also tell you where it comes from. So you have on an octahedron, you have three distinguished triangles which are connected by commutative such that these resulting triangles are commutative. Then the answer is there exists a morphism here, and the final face of the octahedron becomes. So, of course, if this one is not here, then this one wouldn't be here either. So, in other words, you have an octahedron with a hole. One edge is missing. And the faces are such that three of the faces are distinguished triangles, the other ones are commuting triangles. Then you can complete the octahedron such that one of the triangles is distinguished and the other one commutes. That's called the octahedral action. And now, if I really think hard about it, I can also draw the arrows in the right direction, but I won't do it because we're out of time. I'll rather tell you next time what kind of property it is that gets you this action. And so then the next step then is, of course, to prove that if you take the homotopy category over an abelian category, it is triangulated. All these data are already there, and the axioms are satisfied. And then we are almost there, because then we need to go to the derived category, because in general, the homotopy category is not good enough if you don't have both enough injectives and projectives. If you do, then, as we said, projective respectively injective resolutions will do everything for you, but if they are not there, then you are not in good shape yet. You need to one more step to go, namely to formally invert all quasi-isomorphisms to make all resolutions sort of equal. Anyway, I'll do this next Monday.